The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good percentage, a large part, an important part of practicing the Dhamma is being on time. Life is happening, and what we refer to as mindful awareness either keeps pace with that to a certain degree or it doesn't. We all have some mindfulness, we all have some concentration. When our mindfulness and concentration is not quite up to speed, which is not quite on time, then we tend to live on automatic. We tend to live blindly. We tend to live according to the causes and conditions, the conditioning that we've developed over a period of at least this lifetime. And when we're sitting meditation, sometimes we get lost in thought. We may get lost in thought 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. It's okay, that's natural. Then we catch ourselves. We say, oh, mindfulness was a bit slow there. Come back, check. Am I breathing in or am I breathing out? Gently bring ourselves back again and again. As we become maybe a bit more experience, a bit more adept. Mind slips for 5 seconds, 10 seconds, and we think, oh, a bit slow there. Oh, kind of get pulled into the content of that thought. And then we bring ourselves back, establish awareness. Sights, sounds, smells, tastes, cognizing. This is what we project is our reality. Can mindfulness keep pace with that? Perceptions. How much of our world is created by perceptions? Perceptions of what we hear, perceptions of what we see, then project it out. Just taking perception as a meditation in and of itself. How do we perceive ourselves? How do we perceive our experience? Just seeing something, it's very simple. And yet already, with seeing, does the perception I am seeing arise? Immediately reinforcing a sense of self, positing a sense of self there, I separate from that which is being seen. Hearing, it's just sound. Pleasant, unpleasant. And gradually, mind becomes more quiet. I just returned from 2 weeks up in the North Woods. I just noticed, even after a week of being up there, regularly practicing, just being there, start to notice there's lake, there's forest, there's bones, flesh, perceptions, and a lot of silence. So, interesting, just watching the mind. Oh, thoughts not arising. Silence. Feel more and more just not separated from nature. Well, what was it that used to make me feel so distinct from my environment? Gradually melting away a bit. Oh, this is part of the environment too. This is the environment. Just kind of melting into the forest and melting into the lake. Watching the mind that's not thinking. Then the thought arises. What would happen if I had to give a talk and no thought arises? That's what would happen. People would say, "Ah, John, that was so profound." Yeah. So what was it? Oh, it was the silent transmission. It was like a mirror, forcing us to look at ourselves, not finding refuge in the teacher. It's just being quiet. Or it's like, hand someone a pine cone. So, it's a silent transmission. Normally, I live in New Zealand. Coming back to the United States is always a very interesting experience. I love coming back here, and it's kind of a bizarre place. It's lovably bizarre. And it gives me the opportunity to watch reactions and perceptions that arise. Right? Visiting family. Visiting family is great for Dhamma practice. Dad says something as if he's an expert in Buddhism. Categorically, confidently says something that is actually not true about Buddhism. Am I on time? Is my mindfulness on time? If I'm not on time, certainly when I was a younger monk, I was like, oh, could have been a lot more fun, a lot more interesting in a sense. Getting into a bit of a discussion. And I was like, oh. And it just kind of let it wash over. It's like, oh, that's sound coming from Dad. Oh, kind of washes over me, and it's like, should I react? Well, we have to react. Even if we react by being still and aware, that's still a reaction. It's a wise reaction, or moving in that direction. There's a variety of reactions, and it's kind of give the spaciousness. Oh, there's Dad's sounds of Dad, Dad's opinions, Dad's judgment. Buddhist monasticism is an archaic tradition, has no relevance to the modern world. Okay, fine. That's just sound, and then react. How do we react to that? If mindful awareness is on time, then it's like, oh, didn't hit anything. Well, that was great. It's like you go home, visit family. It's a great test. It's like, oh, great. Blood pressure didn't even rise. It's like, oh, I still feel calm and peaceful and centered and balanced. So this experience of what we call reality, being on time, is so important because if we're not on time, we can really make a mess of the whole thing. A mindfulness is that, that aspect of awareness which can convey certain elements of the spectrum of what we project as our reality. Convey increasing amounts of it so that we have more information to work with. Otherwise, we just tend to be aware of very small snippets, here and there snippets. And then even if we're intelligent and well-intentioned, it's very difficult to make wise decision based on insufficient information. So mindfulness is that which conveys information. It's just, it's an impersonal process. It's not like I have to be mindful. But when there is more mindfulness happening, then we notice more things. We become more and more sensitive, more and more aware of other people, of ourselves, of our own perceptions. What are we projecting? And what do I bring to this? How am I assuming a certain reality that is unquestioned? Right? And bringing mindfulness to more and more aspects of normal daily life. And suddenly we start noticing things that we've never seen before. Why is it that the Buddha place so much emphasis on body awareness, the continuity of mindfulness, establishing mindfulness with the body? Every time you reach for something, every time you pick up a cup, every time you drink water, feeling the whole process, the weight of the cup, the movement of the arm, the intention, the gratification of the intention to set things down. Right? Why is it that so much of the training has to do with mindfulness of the body, because it establishes our awareness in a relative continuity in the present moment. If we're aware of the body, then we can be relatively assured that we're aware of something that's happening in the present. Especially when the mind is working so quickly, so fickle, then establishing awareness in the body is very grounded. Especially when there's a lot of energy from the neck up, focusing on parts of the body like the feet, legs, hips, chest, these are areas where we can actually bring the energy back into a grounded, stable position. So whatever we're doing, you're walking, great, you've got meditation time. When we're sitting, you say we're too busy to meditate. Well, next time you're on the toilet, you're sitting. Perfect, right? I mean, what else are you going to do? All right, well, you know, you're just perfect up, and no one's going to, it's like your own retreat time. No one's going to bother you. Like, you're sitting on the toilet. Good. Sitting meditation, right? Body awareness, right? Is there anything here that I habitually don't look at? Just fully aware, established, grounded, take a few deep breaths, everything relaxes, and there's letting go. Right? So establishing bits and pieces throughout our day where we can take that as our meditation to help increase the continuity. Right? Like when we're brushing our teeth, when we're taking a shower, when we're eating. These are relatively simple things that we do throughout the day, but then take that opportunity. This is valuable time. When else are we going to practice? Take these opportunities throughout the day just to sit. You know, breathe. When you're watching your computer screen, once an hour, just stop, close your eyes, take 3 deep breaths. It only takes 15 seconds. It's 15 seconds, 3 deep breaths, 3 mindful breaths, and everyone can do that. That's not outside the realm of a skill level of anybody. 3 deep breaths, and it's so grounding, bring us back into the body, settles us down, and then continue on. It's 15 seconds, very worthwhile invested. With some of these perceptions that we have, some of our habitual habits, very deeply ingrained. So it takes repetition over and over and over again, bringing us back. Is my mindful awareness on time? Are we up to speed? Is it quick enough? Because life keeps happening. Perceptions keep happening. Sights, sounds, smells. Can I be aware of this without being thrown off center? And we get good for a while, and then we start to see, oh, some things are really deeply ingrained. A couple of weeks ago, I was riding in a car with a Tibetan Buddhist nun. She was driving along a mountain road, California. And we were talking about the role of Asian teachers and transmission to the West and how it works with Western students and monastics. And then suddenly this car came around the corner very quickly, half in our lane. She veered off suddenly and said, "Jesus Christ!" And veered back into our lane. And we looked at each other and just... And we just cracked up. It was like, yeah, that is so deep in there. Yeah. Oh, God, we had so much fun. And so much of what seems so important is just what? Where's the substance? I mean, it's good. It's not something we can force ourselves to do. We can't force ourselves not to to be scattered. Even if we have the intention, oh, I'd like to be centered and balanced and peaceful. Well, I'm not going to force myself to be centered and balanced and peaceful and content. It doesn't work. It arises from causes and conditions, which come back to the basic building blocks of, are we paying attention? If we're grounded in our body regularly, then we start to notice our mind more. We start to notice, oh, there's this thought again. Oh, a worry arises, right? Am I caught in the worry? How much time do I spend worrying about the future? You know, a worry arises if mindfulness is there. We notice, oh, there's that worrying again. And then it ceases. And then the mind goes quiet. And noticing there's not just thinking, there's not just activity in the mind, but when something ceases, then there's space. And that space is intrinsically peaceful. Like spaciousness, like silence, is an intrinsic quality of a pleasant peacefulness about it. And when we pay attention to that, then the mind will incline towards that direction. Mind will naturally incline towards that which is peaceful, that which is going to give a greater degree of pleasure. Now, if we're conditioned to think that pleasure is only going to come from paying attention to the thoughts, the actions, the ripples in our consciousness that are calling for attention, then that's what our life becomes. It's only that. But just noticing, okay, well, there's a thought, right? There's thinking, and then it ceases. And then there's space, and then it may arise again. We catch it. Be on time. Mindfulness being on time. We catch it again, and then it ceases. We catch it again, and then it ceases. But then gradually through that, every time it ceases, there's that little bit of there's a little bit of space, in between the thoughts, a little bit of space in our minds. And then what we pay attention to will grow. And if we pay attention to those little slivers of peace and space and centeredness, then that tends to get bigger and bigger until finally that becomes the norm. And then you feel like spacious, and then something arises within that, and you say, oh, there's a worry. But I'm already happy now. Why should I fear for the future? Like, what is, and you see, well, what is the purpose of worrying? Well, I worry because I want to figure out the future so that, because I'm kind of afraid that maybe things won't be pleasant in the future, and so I'm going to try to worry and think about how I can make the future just right so that I have the perfect moment in the future and everything will be fine, and then I'll be happy and content. But actually, I was perfectly happy and content until that worry arrives. like perfectly, oh, present moment. Oh, actually, I have everything I need to be happy right now. Why fear for the future? Because if you want to have a future that's free from worry, then you know, plant the seeds right here and right now. You just be happy here and now. And it actually is taking responsibility. Yeah. That is taking responsibility for the future. So being on time. And then we start to see, oh, these thoughts, what is it that keeps our life going? It's like tornadoes in Minnesota. You look at a tornado and it's just, you know, where's the substance there? There are air molecules and there's energy, but it's very difficult to point to something that is an actual tornado. There's a concept that we place on a moving, whirling, swirling, energetic, but then it ceases, and where does the tornado go? And then we have body, feeling, perceptions, thoughts, consciousness, kind of swirling around, causing destruction, causing physical and emotional destruction. But where's the substance in all of that? And then what happens when the tornadoes of our five khandhas ceases? Where does it go? So being on time with perceptions, catching thoughts, happened to me recently. One time recently where I really noticed, oh, these years of training have paid off. A couple of months ago, New Zealand, Lumpa Sumedho visited. And about 6 months prior to that, we had heard that he was going to come and visit. And he's the most senior teacher in our tradition. And he's in his 80s now. It's unlikely that he would visit again in such a remote place as New Zealand. So we thought it was a very special occasion. And he had been there for the groundbreaking or ground blessing ceremony for our stupa. So maybe we should really finish the stupa now and we'll put the Buddha relics inside the stupa and it'll be a very special occasion. And so whole summer then kind of was focused on getting the whole monastery ready for this very special week. You know, many teachers came and Dhamma talks every night, and then that all culminated with the biggest event we've ever had. And Lumpa Sumedho gave a talk at our stupa, and it was a beautiful day, and we had many hundreds of people there, and then after all the auspicious chanting, then it was all culminating with putting the relics in the stupa. So, to get the relics into the upper portion of the stupa, is kind of shaped like bell-shaped, and the relics were going in the top portion of it. To actually get it up there, we had to figure out how we're going to actually get it up there. Because the box that the relics are in weighed about 200 pounds, because it was filled with crystals. They're all sealed in stone containers and in a stainless steel box and then welded into a plastic polyethylene airtight waterproof box. And all filled with clear crystal chips. So the total content weighed about 200 pounds. So you couldn't just carry it up in a ladder and put it in. So we had to figure out how are we going to actually get it in. So eventually, we found the super heavy-duty boom cherry picker, hydraulic boom arm that would bring us up there. And it was kind of expensive, so we didn't have time to rent it ahead of time to practice. And the big event was on Sunday, and our super hydraulic knuckle boom cherry picker arrived on Saturday morning. And we had it all planned out perfectly. there would be a skilled operator, and myself, and the box of relics, and maybe Ajahn Sumedho. You know, but Ajahn Sumedho, he looked at it, he said, maybe not. And said, that's fine. So the skilled operator and myself and the box of relics would go up at the perfect time with all the Sangha chanting, and I would just ceremoniously push the relics into the stupa, culminating an entire summer's, you know, focus. And then Saturday morning, we could say, well, let's do a practice run. So the skilled operator and myself and the relics went up, and we got to a certain point, and the hydraulic arm boom would not work anymore because it was too heavy with three of us in there, the skilled operator, me, and the Buddha. And all the controls were on the dashboard of this basket. And so suddenly it dawned on me that, well, it wouldn't really be appropriate for the contractor just to go up there and push the relics in. It's like, okay, ceremoniously it doesn't quite work. So it dawned on me, actually, I'm going to have to do it myself. So I started to have to learn how to, I mean, it's just a mass of toggle switches and knobs and a pedal that needed to be depressed at the same time. And you know, it can take you in every direction, left, right, back, forward, high, low, and you hit the wrong one, you can dump yourself out. And so we had all these big events going on, and when we had a break, I would come up and practice with this thing. And go up, down. So, yeah, well, I enjoyed that. And it seemed like it would be fine. It's like, oh, okay, good practice, kind of maneuvering it just in the right position. And out, down. So it's okay, I think I got it. Quick learning curve. And then on the actual day, so Lumpa Sumedho was standing down there, and Lumpa Biek was also a highly respected meditation master, had come from Thailand for the occasion, and all of these invited monks and nuns were all down there, were chanting, and then I'm going up in this lift with the box of relics, and we get to the stage, and I can get it just so it's about just the right spot, and a slight incline so I can push it in. We had a little piece of plywood bridge, put it there, and it was just push it in. And so then I just started to push it in outside of the safety of the basket. So here we go. And then it got stuck because there was only about that much of a gap all the way around. So it got stuck. And it was no longer in the safety of the basket, and it was not yet in the stupa. So it was just kind of hanging in midair. You know, it had a little bit here in the basket, a little bit here in the, you know, the box is like this big. So one corner was in here in the stupa, the other corner was on the basket, but most of it was just in under, you know, it was just hanging in the air. And it was stuck, so I realized I'm going to have to actually maneuver this to get it into the right position now, right? And as it was stuck there, hundreds of people staring, watching, looking up at me, right? Were thinking, you know. And then I felt my blood pressure rise, and I had this vision of I hit the wrong toggle switch. Pulled back, the box of relics tumbles down the side of the stupa and lands on Ajahn Sumedho, our revered teacher, and kills him. And this was a realistic possibility, and it just kind of comes as a flash. It's just, you know, mine's very quick, as it comes as a flash, the whole scenario, as well as the future scenario. 50 years from now, I'll be dead, but my name will come up and said, oh, Ajahn Chendiko. Isn't he the one who killed Ajahn Sumedho? But yeah. It's like in a flash, it all comes up. The whole, you know, this could be a disaster. This could be an absolute disaster. And then you feel that, I felt the panic starting to rise, which would cloud my mind. And I thought, that's panic. But this is clarity. And in this moment, I think being clear and calm would be more useful. Because if I panic, I really am likely to hit the wrong toggle switch. You know, it'd be much more easy to make a wrong decision. And it just dawned on me in the midst of all of this that was like the culmination of like 35 years of meditation practice. to be able to see, okay, well there's panic, and you know, it seemed to be a legitimate time to panic. You know, it seemed to be a reasonable response. Well, I could panic. It's worthy of panic. But then it's okay, well that is a response. And then I felt like, oh, mindfulness was on time. Mindfulness was on time. Just notice, oh, that's not a helpful, wise, beneficial response. How about if I just stay calm? So fortunately I did. And meanwhile, you know, everyone's keep chanting, and they started off. We have a series of photos. Everyone starts off like kind of really hopeful and blissful. You know, like, you know, they're chanting away, all the monks down below chanting. And then kind of halfway through, they're kind of going, a little bit, a little bit. And then later photos are like, you know, it's like they all look so worried. But, you know, because it was kind of going on for a while. And then to their credit, they never stopped chanting. You know, they just kept going and going. I'm like, oh, felt the support of the community. So the thing is, you know, I had to support it with one hand, then put my foot on the pedal about the same level, and then reach up to the dashboard. And so I had to kind of guess where the right toggle switch was. And I knew it, you know, just going a little bit, jip, because it's extended the full length, just a little jip, and it goes boom, 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 boom. Kind of bounces a little bit. And so I just had to pull out. But if I pulled out too far, of course, everything would fall. So, and I had to go down. If I went down too far or anything, I mean, fortunately, I went boop, and I went, it's like, okay. Another adjustment. I tried it again and got stuck. Another adjustment, finally, pushed it all the way in. So, and then after that, then I could really celebrate. After that, it was a sense of, yeah, that it's just one little practical moment where, you know, all these years and years of training really paid off. One of the many opportunities is just like, you know, being with my father. You know, when something is said and you think, okay, is my mindfulness quick enough? So yeah, just stay calm. There's the conditioned response that may not be helpful or beneficial or wise, and then there's a whole range of responses, right? You just say, oh well, let's try to be clear and patient and kind and spacious, and just, you know, look at this from a spacious, balanced viewpoint, and then things kind of fall into place in just the right way. So that happened just before I started traveling, so it's still a very fresh memory. So then you come to America, and America is just full of projected perceptions. It's amazing. It's amazing how strongly we can hold on to our perceptions. When we really look at it, it just dissolves. You look at perceptions, and it's just like, okay, we look at someone, and a perception arises. That's valid in itself. perception arises, and where interpretation arises, but even just the basic perception that arises from our conditioning. Okay, but that's all it is. You know, we perceive certain people as, pleasant, unpleasant, beautiful, ugly, thin, fat, black, white, Hispanic, Asian, you know, all these perceptions that in and of themselves, they're not necessarily a problem. You know, but we just perceive people, we perceive situations, but then we take them so seriously, and that's when the problems start. Just because we perceive something doesn't mean it's real. It may be real to us in what we consider reality, but it doesn't mean it's validly real to anybody else. So when we start to develop a relationship with our perceptions and start to catch them quicker and quicker and realize, God, we are doing it all the time. Even with good-hearted, well-intentioned people who are doing their utmost to be conscious beings in the modern world, we're still doing it all the time. Perceptions that we have of others, perceptions of my partner, perceptions of our parents, perceptions of our children, perceptions of people who are different than us. Right? You know, go into a room or we meet other people, perceive, is this person like me? Oh, this person is like me. We haven't even met them yet. But just based on superficial appearances, you know, we feel, oh, I belong here or I don't belong here. And you can't force people to change their perceptions, but we can be mindful of the process of perceptions arising, and then that starts to undermine the root of the problem. So yes, we perceive, there's a perception. You know, someone who looks different than us comes into our sphere, our vision. What perceptions do we assume? What perceptions arise even without trying? And just being with that, just noticing that, it's neither good nor bad. I mean, it's so easy to blame ourselves if a perception arises and we notice it and say, oh, geez, I'm a bad person because I had a perception of that person being different than me. And no, it's just a perception. Neither good nor bad, but it's not necessarily true. Just because we perceive something, it's not necessarily true. It was just, oh, well, that's a perception. You know, walking down the street here, you look at the different houses. Oh, I perceive that house as beautiful. I perceive that house as ugly. It's like, that's just a perception. You know, you catch it and you say, oh, that's just all it is. And it doesn't kind of throw the mind off balance. It's like, oh, perception of beauty, perception of pleasure. And the mind still may incline towards that which we perceive as beautiful or pleasant. You know, and that's natural, but you know, that's all it is. Oh, there's a perception that kind of pulls our mind that way. If we are not mindful, if our mindfulness is slow, then our mind gets pulled off balance. Or if a perception that maybe brings up anxiety, right? For perception of, we perceive something in some way, and then we can respond with anxiety. We'll just notice, oh, that's just a perception, then it's a conditioned reaction of anxiety. Okay, that's fine, neither good nor bad, but we don't have to take it any further than that. And just that calms down. And then life really becomes interesting. You know, for one thing, life is really interesting. You just notice, oh, there's perception arising of that, and perception arising of that, and that, and that, and how different it is without feeling like we're a slave to our perceptions, without feeling like we have to create this whole reality that we have to form opinions based on our perceptions and fight for these opinions, because if we perceive them and if we hold these perceptions, then they must be right, because we wouldn't intentionally hold perceptions that were wrong. So when people hold different perceptions, sometimes opposite perceptions, if everyone's practicing in this way, it's not a problem at all. This is kind of interesting. Oh, you perceive this as delicious. I don't perceive it as delicious. But the food itself is neither delicious nor non-delicious. It's just perceptions. But we can make life so complicated unnecessarily. You know? In the modern world, it's just, it takes a concerted effort to develop a sense of simplicity. Everything is pulling us towards complication. Material complication, technological complication, emotional complication, and perceptual complication. So much information. So it takes a special concerted effort to try to simplify. And just noticing, you know, if mindfulness is on time, then things become much more simple. Even if life is swirling around us, it's a bit like the eye of a hurricane. It's swirling around, but in the center, it's still. It's still, it's peaceful, right? And coming back to America every year, you know, you come back to them, you live with someone, and perceptions of the other person's, you don't notice so much the gradual changes. But when you come back once a year, and perceptions of people's physical condition changes, what we call aging. And so, oh, and notice how we perceive people differently, you know, when they start to age, you know, when they look different than they did a year ago, or 2 years ago, or 5 years ago, when we last saw them. Or if we have a fixed perception of somebody else, or fixed perception of ourselves, even if it's just a matter of our body. You know, we perceive ourselves looking a particular way, and then it changes, then that's going to be a cause for suffering. Because life is not static. And if our perceptions become static, then that's going to be a cause for friction and suffering. So perceptions need to be fluid enough that they're able to keep pace with the changing nature of life. When we come back and say, oh, a bit more gray hair. Oh, a bit heavier. Oh, a bit thinner. Oh, bit fewer teeth, or, you know, whatever. It's like, oh, perception change, right? And how is that a problem, right? Is it a problem if things change and we don't want them to change? Then when you get down to the culmination of aging, is it bad karma to assist someone in suicide? Is it bad karma to make a conscious decision to end one's own life under certain circumstances? It's a question sometimes Buddhists wonder about with the legal, it may be legally allowable, but then you wonder, karmically, how does that work? Karma is very nuanced. So, although it would be easier to say, oh, this is good karma, this is bad karma, the reality is it's much more subtle than that. Many, many factors determine the results. And even the words good and bad are not very skillful to use because that is subject to condition, social conditioning. Which is bringing this out. If there is an intention to kill, but then there is also all these mitigating factors, and our intention may vary from moment to moment to moment. Intention or motivation is the essence of karma. And so, how then, you really, mindfulness has to be so vigilant to keep pace with it, huh? Especially with the intense decisions that one might make in life. So just watching the motivation, moment by moment, you know, because it changes. It's not just one, it's constantly changing. This really came up for me recently on the plane flight here. Coming to America, I came from Thailand to Malaysia and then had a stopover in Indonesia and then gradually to New Zealand and onward here to the U.S. And one of the legs of that very long journey was from Malaysia to Indonesia. So I'm waiting in the airport lounge. The gate. I was at the gate. A bit tired, a bit kind of just ready to be still and quiet and have a nice quiet flight. And a young woman came and sat down opposite me and said, "Bhante, what is the meaning of life?" And, part of my conditioned response was to kind of roll my eyes and think, internally think, just because I'm dressed like this, people, sometimes kind of strange people come up and ask me, what is the meaning of life in airport gates? And so, but then I say, well, the kind, wise, patient response is to really kind of try to tune into that person and to answer as fully as I could. So we talked a bit about, it's such a vague question, it's almost meaningless, but I tried to tune in to what the person was asking, what she was asking. And we talked a bit, but you could see she was a bit troubled and a bit unstable, and I have to admit, when it was time to board the plane, I was grateful. So, okay, great. I could say, goodbye, have a great flight. And I could go on the plane and just sit quietly. So I got on the plane, and the seat that I was given, there was something wrong with the seat, but there were, half the plane behind me was all empty. So I asked, is it okay if I take one of the seats back there? She said, sure. So I went back and sat back there. And as I was walking back, the same woman said, I want to sit next to you. It was like a, 3-hour flight. So she's like, you wanted to sit like right next to me. And just immediately started, asking all these questions. And so I was like, okay, proper response is patience, empathy, kindness, understanding. Right? This is like how we train in daily life. And then as she was speaking, it became more and more clear that she was really kind of depressed and suffering, and gradually, bits and pieces of her life would start to come out, how she just quit her job, she was so sick of her meaningless work, and relationship with her family was pits. She didn't have any good relationship with any of her family members. She felt she was really ugly. She didn't have a boyfriend. It was like she was really depressed. And she just, And then gradually, we talked about that. And then I kind of say, well, how long are you going to be in Bali for? She was going to Bali. So why are you going to Bali? She says, well, she really just loves Bali and the people there. But she wouldn't kind of answer how long she was going for. And then as we spoke, she said, she had just quit her job. Just quit her job, going to Bali. Okay, well, we talked about possibilities for her life and how she could turn things around and feel better about herself and her situation. And had she ever meditated, and ways of looking at her life. And then it started to dawn on me that she had actually made the decision to go to Bali to kill herself. And at first it was just a thought in my mind, right? It's just a thought. But then I was kind of thinking, I kind of tuned into her. I thought, and then I just, as she was speaking, I just said, "Are you going to Bali to kill yourself?" And then, she just started crying. Now we really have something to talk about. Because she had it all worked out. This was a one-way ticket. And she just felt that she had no other reasonable option, no reason to live. And she was going to Bali because she had been there many times and she felt comfortable there and liked the people, liked the place, and had no reason to go back home for any foreseeable positive possibility of the future. So I didn't try to say, "Oh no, don't do that," or "Oh, that would be bad karma," or try to in any way try to convince her not to do it, but just try to understand. And when she would ask a question, I would answer and give her some feedback. And we talked, and gradually she was just loosening up and relaxing and feeling better. And then, it was really helpful. And then we got off the flight, and we were walking through the airport. I had to go off to the transit lounge. And by that time, she was smiling a bit and laughing. We were joking a bit. And then by the end, we... I had to go into the transit lounge, and she was going to stay. By that time, she was like radiantly smiling by the end. She was like radiantly smiling. So it's like, wow, what a transformation. So I did what any Buddhist monk would naturally do. I took a selfie of us. Like, so both of us like radiantly smiling and happy, and we were laughing, and we took a couple selfies. And then I went off, and she went off, and she has my contact details, but I've never heard from her, so I don't know how to contact her. But people have to make their own decisions in life, and we can try to be a positive influence as much as possible. But people have to make their own moral decisions, understand the moral consequences of their decisions, and then taking in all the possible factors that are available to them, then hopefully come to a wise decision. And again, that comes back to mindfulness. If our mindfulness is only aware of tiny bits of our life, then we just see the suffering, the hopelessness, the meaninglessness, that's not the whole picture. And then we form a reality based on little snippets of awareness that is not realistic. I mean, it's not even realistic according to our entire deluded, projected reality. And so just getting her to kind of broaden that and be aware of a wider spectrum of her own life, she just started to see, it's not actually all suffering. It's not actually all meaningless. There are bits and pieces in there that are peaceful, nice, pleasant, harmonious. And so... Just being as aware as possible letting as much information in as we can handle while staying centered and balanced, then that's about as good as we can do. And then we get more and more information. And when we have more and more correct information about our life and how our minds work, our thoughts, our reactions, our emotions, then naturally the decisions that are based on all of that tend to be increasingly wise. Because if there's ever a time that we really want to be on time with mindfulness, is when we're preparing for death. That's when we really want to be on time. Don't be late. So, yeah, we have time for questions if anyone would like to ask anything.
Thank you, Ajahn. I appreciated what you said about projections and perceptions, I guess it was, rather. And, you know, just because we perceive something doesn't mean it's real. And I imagine, as you know, during your time as a monk, you know, practicing so devotedly, you've also likely had the experience of, you know, just because we don't perceive something, it doesn't mean it's not real. You know, over time, kind of waking up to things that we couldn't see earlier in our practice. And I know that the monastic sangha has rituals around helping us to see our blind spots, and I think that's a really beautiful thing. And I often wish that, you know, culturally in the West we had more opportunities to do that work in community. But I wonder what practical suggestions you could offer us as lay people for how to bring about those kinds of openings to learning about our blind spots in daily life, if you have any ideas around how we can do that both individually and also in community with others. Thank you.
Living with other people.
Living with other people?
Yeah. Yeah. One of the rituals that you talked about in monastic life that helps us see our blind spots is living in community. Often we become monastics because we love the idea of living off in a hut in solitude and becoming transcendently wise and peaceful. And then we ordain and we're thrown into this community of a bunch of nutters, which is a projected perception. And you go... And then suddenly you find yourselves in a community and everyone's practicing intensely and everyone's got their own personalities and people from all different countries in the world and reacting differently to situations. And sometimes you get extreme individuals but just living in community, even if you have wonderful, dedicated, good-hearted people living in community, they will eventually be a mirror for all of our blind spots. Because we can go off to a cave, and that is one aspect of practice. That is very helpful. Be on a retreat, go off into nature, and you can achieve a certain depth that may be more difficult to achieve in a group situation. But as strong as our strengths become, our blind spots can become even equally entrenched. So I've seen this a lot over the years. You know, people who have wanted to go off on their own, you know, not live in communities, and just go off on their own and practice, and they just don't develop the well-rounded qualities. You know, and they may be really good in one area, but then have really wrong opinions in another area that are just not challenged because they don't live with other people. So living with other people is, you have to see it as these are great opportunities. Partners, those little idiosyncrasies that used to seem so cute, you know, in the first couple of years. Oh, they're so cute the way they do that. After a while, it's like, God, why do they do this? So irritating. Why do they have to keep doing that? I thought they would have changed by now. And then you realize, oh, well, it's not really, the problem's not really with someone else, right? It's like, why do I perceive that? That is perception. Why? What is the cause for that perception that I'm projecting? And then that becomes a mirror. And then we start to gradually wear away all of the rough edges. And if we just live alone, we tend to choose the type of reality that we want to live in. When we live with other people, they are so out of our control. We're just confronted with opinions, differences, unpredictable emotions, and then what is our reaction to that? And then that's a constant teaching. So, in terms of the fast path to enlightenment, living with other people is very good. It's very helpful to make sure that we're staying grounded and centered and balanced. Yeah. And then with that, of course, just developing this continuity of awareness. I mean, I don't even have time as Abbot anymore to sit meditation 8 hours a day like I used to. So I've had to learn how to make every activity throughout the day into meditation. Now that's easy to say, but how do you do it? Say, well, what is meditation? Meditation is not just sitting with our cross-legged, with our eyes closed. What's actually going on in the mind when we're meditating that we can then take into walking, bathing, pooping, brushing your teeth, you know, these simple activities. Start with simple activities, and then gradually you can bring that same quality into more challenging situations like a conversation. A simple conversation with another person is very complicated, right? It takes a lot of mindfulness to have a concept in our minds that is then goes out, we choose certain words and already it's not the same as the concept, and then the other person interprets those words based on whatever mood or social conditioning they are experiencing at that time. That forms a concept in their minds which is only somewhat related to the concept that we originally had, and then we try to form an understanding. So there's a lot going on in a simple conversation, you know, the thoughts, the emotional reactions, listening non-verbally to other people, right? So that is real practice. I mean, that is just full on, but there's so much happening so quickly that if mindfulness isn't trained with the simple things first, we just get blown over by it. There's so much going on. We just get swept up into our own emotions and reactions or thoughts and worries. So just start with the small things. Take the opportunity when you are alone or when there's nothing pressing happening, just to practice. If you're sitting with a cup of water, you just practice drinking, paying attention to all the sensations. Try to get as close to reality as you can. And just notice every time that we start to develop a whole layer of interpretation. You lift a glass up, you think, oh, well, there's just sensations, and there's sight, and there's kind of physical feelings, and there may be a sensation of thirst or desire, right? That's getting close to reality, closer and closer to the basic raw materials of reality. So you have to train with very simple things first. And just notice how quickly it changes when you say there's just seeing, but then you look at the cup and there's patterns and you think, oh, where's that come from? Oh, that's very beautiful. If it's beautiful, it's nice. You know, I like it. It's pleasant. Oh, if it's beautiful, I'd like to keep it. Maybe I can get one of these. Maybe if I ask Mark, he'll give me this cup because you know, I'm a monk and he respects me, so maybe if I just say, oh, Mark, you have such a beautiful cup. So, Ajahn, would you like this cup? And then, but then they think, oh, no, that might actually be coming from greed, and I'm trying to overcome greed, so that wouldn't be proper. So I'll just sit and check it. Right? So, you know, life can get so complicated, it's just like, huh, just drink. And then you train simplicity. I mean, you have to work. America, you have to work really hard to be simple. You just train in simplicity. Just drink. Done. And then activity by activity, moment by moment, mindful awareness gets stronger and stronger and stronger, and then when we're confronted with something which is emotionally a bit charged, and we have all this training and we're ready, and we say, oh, well, there's that reaction. I could react like that, but would that be helpful? Probably not. I'll just react like this.
My name is Curtis. I was wondering, so you're talking about being on time and the conjunction between causes and conditions and bringing mindfulness to the present so that you're available to the moment and not being pulled, like you spoke about your conversation with your father, or I can think of many conversations I had this week. Yet, I guess I was reading something recently about something that the Buddha taught about not keeping company with fools, I think he said.
Yes.
So that he seemed to be saying, or the teachers seemed to be saying, that there was some sort of energy around that, or something was contagious around that or something. So I was... I'd like your observations about that.
When we have a choice, then it is wise to spend time with people who have qualities that we aspire towards. If you want to be calm, spend time with calm people. If you want to be wise, spend time with wise people. If you want to be rich, spend time with rich people. If you want to be nasty and greedy and horrible, spend time with those type of people. Right? Depends on what we aspire towards, because we are conditioned by everything. You know, we're conditioned by the people we spend time with. Now, we can only choose the people we spend time with to a certain degree. Right? There's a lot that's just out of our control. And that's okay, and that's where life is, and that's where we can learn as well. Often it's the people that we wouldn't choose to be with that can expose our blind spots, right? Or give us the opportunity to be patient, forgiving, and develop those qualities. But if you have a choice, then yes, boy, by all means, you know, spend time with people who are going to encourage and support those things that we want to develop in ourselves. Yeah? And particularly, if Dhamma is an important part of our life or something that we would inspire towards, then spend time with people who are practicing the Dhamma, or at least that's important to them. They don't have to be enlightened, right? But at least supportive. Right? Or even if they're not Dhamma practitioners, they might be calm, wise, friendly, balanced, cheerful, nice people. I mean, it's Minnesota. Everybody's cheerful. So, clarify what is it that I aspire towards and aspire to develop within myself, and do I know people who have those qualities, and then could I maybe learn something from them just by being around them? Right? Same thing with our environment. If we have the choice, then it's wise to put ourselves into an environment which is going to be conducive to what we want to develop. Right? We don't always have the choice. Sometimes it feels like we have very little choice in what environment that we live in. You know, the job environment, the living environment, the natural environment. But if you have a choice, then, yeah, I mean, it's very clear. You know, the Buddha didn't say, ordain monastics and go into the heart of the city and practice meditation. You know, he said it was always encouragement to go off into nature, you know, go off into the forest, into the mountains. Yeah? Because we can't help it. We are conditioned by our environment. And that's one of the roles of monasteries, like our monastery in New Zealand. People come out of the city before they've said or done anything. They've said, oh, it's so peaceful here. I just feel so peaceful. And that is already, for them, that's already a big thing. Just to have a feeling of being calm and peaceful for an hour, right? Even if they haven't meditated or we haven't had any discussions or anything. So the environment does affect us. So if we have a choice, we can. But we can also get attached to, you know, if we can get attached to the idea, oh, I should only hang out with wise people, not hang out with foolish people. I perceive you as foolish. Get out of my life. So that usually doesn't work very well. So, and even, you know, you also have to just be careful with what we perceive. If we perceive, oh, I perceive this person as wise. I perceive this person as foolish. I perceive this person as smart. I perceive this person as useless. Those are just perceptions. They may be true to a certain degree. They may not be. But just be aware that that's just our perception. So even though if we're just putting it into a line of chanting, we say, you know, it's auspicious to spend time with the wise. And one should avoid spending time with the foolish. But when you break it down, you know, it's obviously much more nuanced and complicated than that, based on our perceptions.
Thank you.
My question is just related to possibly work, but when a lot of the activity in the daily life is around, even predicated on thought and thinking, analysis, opinions, writing, I find that I get oftentimes lost in that. I see other people in the same way, and I'm sure that you do a lot of writing, and how do you kind of work with that? Because you're actually obviously working with the thinking part of the mind and wanting to be observant on that and aware of what's going on. But, you know, honestly, I can find myself working for 8 hours and all of a sudden, you know, with 20 pages of written text and I've almost lost the day in some ways.
Yeah, I used to love to write, especially before I was a monk. I used to love to write, and then I noticed when I was the first few years of being a monk, there were so many new, wild, strange experiences and strange people, and I just wanted to write, like, describe people's characters and all these interesting situations, and I just had to restrain myself because it was just fueling so much thinking. So I thought, no, you know, if I just keep fueling this, then I'll just be thinking and thinking and vocabulary, how can I phrase this in a more interesting way? And I realized it's not really what I'm here for. So I had to actually set it down for a while. But then later, I find undertaking the duties, the administrative duties or teaching duties involves much more cognitive engagement. So one thing you do is just take a break. If you find yourself going for hours and hours, then just set an alarm. Whether that's something on your phone that goes off once every 45 minutes or so, once an hour, then just set an alarm that just, and so as soon as I hear that bell, I'm going to stop, close your eyes, take 3 deep breaths. That helps just to break the flow. especially at a computer. It's so easy just to get drawn into the visuals, the information, the screen itself. You know, can kind of develop a certain type of samadhi that is not necessarily conducive for developing wisdom, but you just get drawn into it, and then time passes very quickly. And just writing consciously, right? Just practice. You can actually practice. It's like we learn how to do things fast and not very mindful, but then just stopping and learning how to, okay, I'm going to eat and drink very mindfully. I'm just going to walk mindfully. We know how to walk. We're just going to walk mindfully, paying attention to each step. We'll do the same thing with writing. You know, I'm just going to write a sentence, being aware of the whole process, and then stop. And take a breath, and write another sentence, aware of the whole process. Right? And it doesn't really take that much more time, but it feels a lot slower. It feels a lot slower, and then gradually, you know, we create new habits of how to relate with writing, typing, information processing, communication, in a way that maybe doesn't throw us off center so much, or we don't just get lost in the content of it all. Or just chuck it all in. Thank you. It's always a pleasure to come back. And I was just up in Grand Rapids, in the birthplace of Judy Garland. And it is kind of true, there's no place like home. So every time I come back to South Minneapolis and look around, it feels like, oh, it still feels like home.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.